This is Neijing Now, prioritizing well-being.
Neijing is the vitality that shields us from disease.
Neijing Now, placing and taking responsibility for the health of the individual and the planet. From molecular biology to global ecology, from political, social, economics to psychology and spirituality. Neijing Now, demystifying medicine, empowering host resistance. We can be found on the web at neijingnow.org, neijingnow.org. I'm Dr. Jayashree Chander, and I welcome you to another edition of Exploring Neijing Now. In this episode, Dr. Owen Brody explains the relationship between the bacteria in our intestines and our environment.
It's the same way that cows digest grass, we digest our food as well. Thankfully, we don't produce as much methane as cattle, though.
And Jeff Conant tells us about ecological toilets.
The best way, the lowest cost way, the most ecological way, the simplest, most low-tech way to deal with human waste. And it turns out that the way to do that is to use a hole in the ground.
Dr. Owen Brody is a microbial ecologist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in Berkeley, California. He shares with us some fascinating research on the bacteria in our soils and environments, and in the intestines of humans, animals, and even insects. Dr. Owen Brody, welcome to Neijing Now.
Oh, thank you.
Dr. Brody, you are a staff scientist in the Earth Sciences Division at the Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory. Could you please tell me a little bit about your work?
So we study environmental microbes from a range of environments, from contaminated soils, urban aerosols, human guts, insect guts, wastewater treatment plants, and some marine environments also. We monitor organisms and how they change in response to either climate change or antibiotics, etc.
So basically you're studying bacteria that are in all these different environments.
Correct. And there's a wide range of bacteria in the environment, and we share a lot of the same bacteria in our gut that are present in soils, for example, or in the air that we breathe. And we're able to detect all of these types of organisms by using relatively advanced technology, looking at the DNA of those organisms and how the DNA in soils matches the DNA that you might find in your gut.
See, that's very interesting, because you think of a piece of food that falls on the ground as something dirty that you might not want to eat because it would be dirty with bacteria, but you're saying that those same bacteria are already in our gut.
There's definitely a subset of those bacteria are in our guts. There's obviously a fine balance between where you drop your food and whether you eat it again. I certainly encourage my two-year-old son, for the most part, to pick his food back up and eat it again. I think it's not something to be worried about, I think.
Wait. You encourage your two-year-old son to eat the food that has fallen on the ground?
Absolutely. I think the more exposure to environmental organisms that humans get as their immune system is developing is extremely important for a balanced development of that immune system.
You're not worried about your child getting parasites and diarrhea and getting deathly ill?
Not in a Western society. I think generally the locations that food may fall is probably not impacted by sewage or wastewater or anything like that. So only under those conditions would I be concerned.
That's very interesting. And you study bacteria, so you should know.
Well, I have an idea about some environmental organisms. I'm not an immunologist, but I appreciate the role that microbes play in our developing immune system.
So tell me more. Tell me more about this relationship between the bacteria in the soil and the bacteria in our guts.
Well, there's what's called the hygiene hypothesis. And this is a hypothesis that individuals growing up or when their immune system is developing under hyper-clean environments. For example, what we see today, you know, in the Western society, everything is cleaned and disinfected. These individuals tend to have a higher incidence of allergic response, asthma, etc. Whereas when you look at individuals who grow up on farms, tend to have a much lower incidence of asthma or imbalanced immune systems. Individuals that grow up in a household with pets are less likely to develop allergic response like asthma. There's a connection there, and it seems to be that exposure to a wide range of organisms, environmental organisms, from an early age impacts our immune system development and may result in a more balanced immune response.
This is all very interesting, and we've discussed some of this before in some previous episodes of Neijing Now. And it is radical thinking for the Western world. Can you tell me about the kinds of organisms that are in the environment that you also find in the gut?
Yeah, so the gut is dominated by a couple of different types of organisms. And these organisms typically take large molecules of your food and break it down into smaller molecules that your body can then absorb and use as nutrients.
So they do the pre-digestion?
They do the pre-digestion. This is the same way that cows digest grass, we digest our food as well. We would not be capable of getting nutrition from most of our foods without these bacteria in our gut. Particular types of organisms are more efficient at breaking down different types of food compounds. And in that way, it also works in the reverse, where the type of food we take in also determines to some extent the types of microorganisms in our gut. So we can actually change the types of organisms in our gut by changing our diet. And that's something you see in the Western world compared to non-Westernized societies. High sugar diets result in a very specific type of bacterial community in your stomach.
Can you say what that is?
For example, in obesity, there are organisms in your gut that have a greater ability to extract energy from your food. So whether a person has a predisposition to obesity or not, what's been shown recently in the literature is that the bacteria that develop in an obese gut are actually extracting more energy. So not only is somebody more obese, but they're actually extracting more calorific content from their food than somebody who is lean.
That seems kind of counterproductive.
It is counterproductive. It's what we call the positive feedback on the problem. One thing that interests me and what we do a lot of research here on is how bacteria in soil change carbon in soil, turn over carbon. And they're very similar processes to what happened in your gut. You have plants decaying. As plants die, drop their leaves or roots die, the carbon from those is then transformed in the soil. And the same process happens in your gut. So that's why you see a lot of the same types of bacteria in the soil as you would in the human gut.
I hadn't thought of that before, that digesting a leaf of lettuce would be done by the same type of bacteria that would digest a fallen leaf. Okay, great. That's interesting. Can we talk about the waste that comes out of our bodies and how the composition of bacteria in that waste interacts with the outside world?
As you progress through the digestive tract, you've got very distinct regions. There's a lack of oxygen as you progress through. The oxygen is being used up by the organisms as they feed on the carbon. And then eventually, when you excrete your waste products, there's pretty much no oxygen left. So these are all anaerobic organisms, organisms that are capable of living without oxygen for some time. When you excrete and your waste products then make it to sewage treatment plants, then some of those strict anaerobic organisms either die or they produce things to allow them to survive, like spores. There is possibility for these organisms then to be released into water bodies when sewage treatment plants have leakage problems following storm events. Usually these sort of run off of sewage into coastal areas that results in waterborne illnesses, Vibrio, cholera, etc. These things typically, they've come through the digestive system, they've grown up within our bodies, and then they make it through to sewage treatment plants. And if sewage treatment is not effective or if there's a leak, then these organisms are then released back into contact with humans.
So if they came from our bodies, then why should they make us sick when they re-enter our body?
That's a great question. Usually it's a case of numbers. Numbers or location. So these organisms, they're in low numbers when we ingest. They make it through and then they multiply in our lower digestive tract. They're then in high numbers when they're excreted from the body. And then when they're taken back in, if they're consumed in higher numbers, then they can cause a disease.
So it's the quantity of the bacteria.
Also, it is the type of bacteria also. Certain bacteria, they have a greater ability to cause disease.
Can we talk about where our waste goes? We have chosen as a society, to at least in the Western world, to put our waste in water and often into clean water and then send it to some place that can take the waste out of the water. Can you talk about that from a microbiological standpoint?
So in that case, we're actually using the microbes to process the waste themselves. So either the microbes in the waste or the microbes that are picked up by the waste en route to a wastewater treatment plant. Once in a wastewater treatment plant, then there are various stages. These stages then take advantage of different abilities of microbes. One stage uses microbes to break down the organic material that's in there, to detoxify it, to remove phosphorus, to remove nitrogen, all of these things that we don't want being released into the environment. So we can use microbes to either remove these nutrients or to transform these nutrients. during this process as well, by changing the environment so that it is so different from the human gut, most of the organisms that survive in the human gut will not survive these conditions. So it's a way of removing the potentially pathogenic or disease-causing organisms from our waste products. Typically, by the time you get to the third treatment step, tertiary treated wastewater, most pathogens have been removed below a safe level. But that's not always the case. We've seen quite a few instances here in the Bay Area where wastewater treatment plants have either failed or have leaked in response to storms. And this results in contamination of water sources, but also contamination of recreational water, such as beaches and beach closures. And that can have significant economic ramifications.
What is the value of bypassing the water step and just putting our waste directly into the soil?
That's a possibility, and that's being looked into pretty widely. And there's quite a bit of research in Europe on this, actually. It's rare to see untreated sewage applied to land, particularly land that's going to be used for agricultural use. Typically, the products or the sewage is treated in one of a few ways. Basically, these are called digestive processes.
Appropriately so.
Appropriately. And these processes take the waste material, they incubate it. During the incubation, the breakdown of the organic material in the sewage causes temperature to increase. And as temperature increases, then the pathogenic organisms tend to die. So it's a way of effectively sterilizing the waste products without adding any energy to it. The microbes produce their own energy, they increase the heat, and then the pathogens die off.
Like having a fever.
Like having a fever. So this is one way of reducing the numbers of disease-causing organisms prior to spreading this material on land. That deals to some extent with the biological components of human waste. There are also other components such as heavy metals that are accumulated, that are taken in, and you excrete these as well as waste products. One of the issues with spreading this material on agricultural lands is that you're spreading heavy metals as well.
What if you were to just have your waste go into your own soil in your own backyard?
Well, that shouldn't be personal choice. In areas of high population, the soil is not disconnected from water sources. You have a rainfall event, and then potentially pathogenic organisms are released from your soil into water sources. In most municipal areas, the drinking water sources are chlorinated, so that's probably not an issue there. However, in maybe more rural environments, these organisms could make it into groundwater, which is used as a source of drinking water. That's certainly not something you'd want to see happening. Even if it's buried within the soil, rain filters down through the soil into groundwater and then can transport those organisms into groundwater.
How would you characterize the difference between human waste and other animal waste in terms of the bacteria?
They're actually very similar. There have been a number of studies showing that diet is a strong predictor of types of microorganisms. Herbivores and carnivores would have a very different type of organisms in their gut. We'd have a very different gut composition from cows, for example.
The reason I had asked the question was other animals are not sending their waste to treatment plants. They're just going on the soil and all their microbiome is going directly into our environment and possibly contaminating our water.
In that case, it comes back to a density issue. You have a high concentration of humans in one area producing vast quantities of waste that needs to be treated in some way before it's released back into the environment. The same thing happens when you have high intensity of animal production, such as cows or pigs, or you have treatment plants for cow manure and for pig waste as well. And the same issues happen as well when you have storm events, you have release of animal manure into water bodies as well, you have a potential for disease. One of the issues is there's a host-specific effect as well, in that we're more likely to have disease caused by bacteria that are of human origin than of animal origin.
Isn't that interesting?
It makes sense when you think about it. These organisms have evolved with us. They've evolved within the human host. They have developed capacities to infect the human host, and the human host has developed capacities to fend off these organisms. So when you ingest organisms that have originated in another animal, those organisms don't have the defenses to withstand the human's immune system, whereas organisms that have evolved within the human immune system have developed defenses. That's not always the case, and some great examples of that are E. coli, and that finds its way into the environment either through cow excrement or its passage through humans, through human excrement. We've had quite a few instances of that in California, for example, in spinach and lettuce, where irrigation water has been contaminated with this bacterium. Now, the sources of that bacterium is controversial, whether it's from cows that are in adjacent fields directly from the cow manure or whether it's from the irrigation water. The source of it is relatively controversial. So this is an example of an organism that has evolved within a cow but has now evolved to cause disease within humans and pretty significant disease as well.
You're saying that in general the bacteria that cause disease in humans are typically found in human guts?
Yes, they're typically of human origin.
I'm curious to know about the microbiome of other living beings.
We also do research on insects. One of the reasons we're interested in insects, beyond purely the interest of science and what allows insects to live and survive, is that their ability, specific insects, their ability to break down plant materials and to use plant materials as a source of energy. For example, we're working on these beetles called best bugs. And these beetles feed on the bark of dead trees. This is a very nutrient-poor environment, as you might imagine. And the beetles have developed or have cultivated a microbial community in their guts that allows them to break down lignin and cellulose from wood. Now, this can be very useful for us to understand because it allows us to understand what types of organisms are necessary to break down these complex plant materials. And we would hope to be able to use that information to make biofuels. And there's been a lot of work also recently on termites. And termites are a bad word in the Bay Area. Every home inspection has a termite report, and because termites like eating wood. But they can also be very useful because their ability to break down wood can also help us to take waste materials from agriculture and turn it into fuels.
That is fascinating. You know, I never think of insects having guts in the first place. And to think of the bacteria in their guts is very fascinating.
Yeah, there's a wide range of insects that are of a lot of interest to people working on biofuels. I know that there's a group in Australia looking at the guts of wallabies. Any really organism that feeds on plant materials, and particularly woody plant materials, which are not typically used in food production, these are very attractive for biofuels because they're already waste products, they're low cost, and if we can identify relatively efficient ways of getting sugars out of those complex polymers, then we can use those to make ethanol or biodiesel or all of these things that can contribute at least to weaning us off fossil fuels. Yeah.
That's great. That's wonderful work. Do you have anything else you're very excited about in the work that you're doing?
Well, it's very related to all of this. We do a lot of work on climate change. I think people don't necessarily think of climate change affecting bacteria, but it does. Climate change can have very profound effects on bacteria, and we're interested in looking at particularly bacteria in soil. As the planet warms and as the concentration of CO2 increases, that affects the way bacteria function in the soil. They can become more active when the temperature increases. When they become more active, they start to degrade plant materials more rapidly, and that releases more CO2 to the environment in some cases. So in that case, it's a positive feedback. And that can be potentially a very strong positive feedback. Some of my colleagues are looking at this in the Arctic, where a lot of the world's carbon is stable. It's stored in permafrost. But as temperature increases, this permafrost is likely to melt. And as it melts, the bacteria that are living in this permafrost, even though it's frozen, they're still alive. They wake up and then they start feeding on the carbon that has been stored in the permafrost, releasing potentially large amounts of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, which again can feed back positively to global warming. We're interested in trying to understand how these processes happen and which types of microorganisms in the soil are more or less sensitive to the changing climate. By being able to understand how they respond, we may be able to predict better how much CO2 will be in our atmosphere in 20, 50, 100 years, and that's necessary for climate models.
That also brings up the question of if climate change is going to be affecting the bacteria in the soil, we can also expect that that will also affect the bacteria in our intestines and how we digest our food and what comes out.
Possibly. I'd say that effect will be more indirect. We're a pretty good buffer from the environment. We're a nice incubator for bacteria. We live our lives at 37 degrees Celsius, and the bacteria in our gut are pretty happy at 37 degrees. So the temperature effects in the environment would probably not affect the bacteria in our gut. The increases in CO2 in the atmosphere, it's a relatively small increase in terms of our physiology. What we might see happening is ecosystems change, environments change. For example, when you have warming, you get a change in the range of particular types of plant species. Trees that would normally inhabit the snow line in the Sierras. As warming increases and the snow line moves, those trees move. So we'll see a change in plant species, which may affect agricultural production across wide different types of environments.
We will also see a change in the composition of bacteria in the soils.
Yes, actually we're seeing it now. We've been looking at the effect of changing rainfall. California, actually both Northern and Southern California, are predicted to have significant changes in rainfall over the next 50 years. What we can expect is probably longer, drier summers and more infrequent rain events. Those rain events may be more severe, but more infrequent. What that does to soil microbes is that it causes a significant stress that changes the types of organisms, and that may change the way carbon is processed in soil. That could feed back again to the atmosphere, but it could also feed back to the types of plants that are capable of growing on those soils, the types of crops we're able to grow, the need for irrigation, etc.
And once the types of bacteria that are growing in the soil and in the environment change, that's what's available for us to ingest.
That's true. One example of how that might affect us directly is in desertification.
Can you explain that?
Previously intact land being degraded and soil being lost to the atmosphere. You see this in sub-Saharan Africa. It's a very big problem. Many, many tons of dust are being transported in the atmosphere from Africa to the Caribbean and are causing illness and disease, coral disease in the Caribbean. This dust is not just soil. It's not just chemicals. It's not just minerals. It's also microbes. Dust events have been associated with outbreaks in Africa of meningitis, for example. So we can potentially see, as the types of microbes change in soil and as soil is being released into the atmosphere, that also changes the inoculum, the types of organisms that we breathe in or ingest from the environment.
Yeah, and the types of bacteria that are in the soil also will be the types of bacteria that are on our food. When we wash our food, we aren't sterilizing our food.
Correct. Yes, it could have an effect on the organisms that we ingest through our food as well.
So with that, it may also affect our capacity to digest our food.
It could. I think that will happen along evolutionary timescales. I don't think we're going to see anything along those, that sort of effect within our lifetime.
We might experience a little more gas.
We may experience a little more gas, that's correct.
A little more methane release into the environment, a positive feedback loop.
Exactly, it might have a positive feedback.
They speak about the positive feedback loop with cattle raising too, right?
They do. Thankfully, we don't produce as much methane as cattle, though.
Great. Anything else you'd like to add, Owen?
Well, yeah. Some of the things that we're also interested in, it's a direct connection between the human waste and the environment, is antibiotic resistance. What we see is that as the use of antibiotics, particularly in Western society and now in developing countries for animal husbandry, etc.
And even in developing countries, people are able to just go pick up antibiotics without a prescription.
Right, it's less regulated. While the use of antibiotics is being more regulated in Western society, you see that maybe what was happening 20, 50 years ago in Western societies is now happening in developing countries. Then as you consume antibiotics, potentially when they're not necessary, even when they are necessary, you select for bacteria that are resistant to these. There are famous examples, the MRSAs, Superbug. What we see is that the ability to break down these antibiotics, to be resistant to them, is excreted in your waste products. So this is usually coded by pieces of DNA, and bacteria can share these pieces of DNA. This DNA is excreted, it's released into the environment, and then this DNA can be taken up by normal organisms that previously were not resistant to these antibiotics. This is something that is concerning, particularly when you're talking about using waste products, adding them to agricultural land or release from sewage. One possible effect of that could be the spread of antibiotic resistance. And there has been some research looking at the impact of animal husbandry, so near farms that use antibiotics to promote growth of the animals. They found that the indigenous soil bacteria have a higher proportion of antibiotic resistance than would be expected in a nearby field that haven't been exposed to these animals. It's pretty clear that this resistance does spread through the environment. The question that's remaining is, how long does it last?
That's incredible. What you're saying is the way that bacteria become resistant to antibiotics is through changing their DNA, and that helps them to stay alive despite being exposed to antibiotics. And then the bacteria can share their DNA with other bacteria. So when humans or animals that have been taking antibiotics shed their waste into the environment, other bacteria can then get the DNA code for becoming resistant to those antibiotics. This would mean more bacteria would become resistant to our antibiotics than we would otherwise predict.
So this is actually really important work.
And we exacerbate the problem, too, by putting antibiotics in laundry detergent, in hand soaps, in cleaners of all sorts.
Yeah, and typically in those products, they're, I guess, what I would call antimicrobials rather than antibiotics. These are broad-spectrum, harsh chemicals. They're not the same types of chemicals that are ingested by people. But nevertheless, they share some similar mechanisms of resistance in bacteria. So by making bacteria resistant to one type of antibiotic, you can potentially increase the resistance to other types of related antibiotics. It brings up an important point. This goal to sterilize everything, it comes back to the hygiene hypothesis. We've evolved with our bacteria, and we've done pretty well evolving with our bacteria. The bacteria we have on our body and in our body are specifically adapted to humans. And there's a very complex community dynamic going on. Some bacteria are preventing pathogenic bacteria growing. And by destabilizing the types of microorganisms that we have in our gut and or on our skin, we then allow these opportunistic organisms to come in and cause disease. Really, probably the best defense against pathogens are other microbes, allowing them to fight off other organisms. While we use these antibacterial hand soaps, etc., you know, we're removing maybe one of our first lines of resistance to infection. We have an army of microbes that are fighting for us. And then if we decommission that army of microbes, then we're vulnerable.
Very well said. And then, of course, the other line of defense is to improve your own resistance.
Right. And that's intimately associated with your gut microbes, but also your stress. Stress levels are one thing that has been proven to affect your immune system and your immune response, and also to affect your microbes, your microbial community. This is not my field, but keeping yourself healthy, keeping yourself happy and keeping active is definitely one line of defense as well. And especially keeping your digestive system healthy.
Fantastic. Thank you so much, Dr. Brody. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
That was Dr. Owen Brody, microbial ecologist at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the bacteria in your intestines or the bacteria in your world, feel free to comment on our website at www.najingnow.org. That's NEIJINGNOW.ORG. Or on the Facebook page for Naging Now. Din, tar kit dhi, kradhin din na na ti. Kratinna tar kit dina katta dina gatha tariki tagitete tagitarikita digitete digitarikita nagitete nagitarikita tagitete tagitarikita tagitarikita digitarikita nagitarikita tagitarikita tagitete digitete nagitete tagitete ta 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 ta. Jeff Conant is an independent journalist covering environmental justice, ecological sanitation, water privatization, and resource colonization issues. He's the lead author of a widely translated popular education manual, A Community Guide to Environmental Health. He explains to us how ecological toilets work. Warning to parents, at times, Jeff does refer to stool as S-H-I-T. Jeff, welcome to Naging Now.
Thanks.
You're kind of an expert in toilets.
I use them. I have used them since I was 3. And I actually wrote and coordinated a book called A Community Guide to Environmental Health, which is a popular education guide to how communities around the world do and can manage our resources, our environments, in ways that are healthy and sustainable. And as part of this book, I researched toilets, compost toilets, dry toilets, different kinds of sanitation systems in several countries around the world in order to help think through the question of what works for people and for the environment.
That's great. That was through the Hesperian Foundation.
Yep. Yeah.
They do good work. So tell us about toilets and, you know, what are our options?
Well, Dr. JC, we have a number of options. Amazingly enough, we're here in California in the U.S. What's happened with Western industrial development is that we believe here in the quote-unquote first world that the only dignified, useful, healthful, reasonable toilet to use is an indoor flush toilet where we pee and poo into water, and that water goes through pipes to a sewage treatment plant, and then the material is taken out and the water is treated and so on. Turns out that that is a very complicated, expensive, kind of roundabout way to deal with the problem. And when I began to research the question of toilets around the world, I was specifically interested in compost toilets and ecological sanitation systems where we can cut out the middleman and figure out the best way, the lowest cost way, the most ecological way, the simplest, most low-tech way to deal with human waste. And it turns out that the way to do that is to use a hole in the ground.
Awesome. Yes, I agree. I mean, it's a little bit illogical to take our human waste and put it into perfectly clean water and then send it off to another place to have the now soiled water become clean again. It's very illogical and labor intensive and not cost effective. So tell us about the hole in the ground.
The hole in the ground. It's very complicated route we have to take to get to the hole in the ground. Essentially, a very common toilet used around the world is the basic pit toilet, which is literally a deep hole in the ground. That has some real problems, namely that you risk contaminating the water table when you poo and pee into a deep hole in the ground without regard for what happens there afterwards.
And it also doesn't smell very nice.
Right. Well, what's happening is the shit essentially isn't being eaten by microbes because you're not putting anything in there that allows it to be digested, and it stagnates and it stinks.
Yeah, basically the bacteria still needs some more food to continue to grow and to multiply, so it needs some other input.
Mm-hmm. And so to turn a simple pit toilet into a compost toilet, you throw some straw, some sawdust, some cellulosic material, some dry carbon in there with every use, and that gives the microbes something to eat. But in a deep pit toilet, there's just too much volume to generally deal with, and you still risk contaminating the groundwater. So in a compost toilet, what you do is you have a sealed chamber and you remove the waste either, you know, as it's being composted or after it's been thoroughly composted. And then there's a whole other kind of toilet, which is a dry toilet, where rather than adding carbon, you add lime or ash or some other kind of desiccating material that does not give the microbes something to eat, but rather desiccates it, dries it out, and thereby extracts the water from any of the potential pathogens that are in there and kills them that way.
So what I'm hearing you say is that a composting toilet is a further modification on a pit toilet, and that there are two types. One you're calling a composting toilet, and the other one you're calling a dry toilet.
And I think they're generally categorized as types of ecological toilets. One is composting. In other words, there's a biological process happening where you're making compost. And the other is called a dry toilet. That's the standard name. So they're both considered ecological because they are taking advantage of ecological cycles rather than enslaving the water or contaminating the water.
Great. Okay, so we're talking about ecological toilets, and there are two types of ecological toilets. The composting toilet and the dry toilet.
Yes.
Okay, can you tell us a little bit more about the details of the composting toilet? How does it work?
How does it work?
It's still a wet process.
The wet-dry question is important here because in a compost toilet, you poo and pee.
Into the same chamber.
Same chamber. So we're talking about mixed waste. And this is important because we essentially, in a compost toilet, you pee and you poo. So you're mixing those two. In a dry toilet, you actually separate your pee and your poo. And that sounds like it could be complicated, but actually there are toilet seats that are designed to do this that are pretty widely used in some places.
How do they do that?
Well, if you think about it, you pee forward and you poo downward, men and women both. And so it's actually not that hard to design a toilet seat where your pee goes in one place and your poo goes in another, or you design it such that you only use it when you poo and you can urinate elsewhere. This is an important distinction because mixed waste is a major problem, and that's one of the issues with standard Western industrial sanitation systems or sewage systems. You're taking dry and wet waste and you're mixing it with water and you're mixing it with whatever else is in that water, antibiotics, chemicals, paint thinner, you know,
cleaning detergents.
Cleaning, all of that stuff. Anyway, that's a whole other issue. So in a compost toilet, over time, the material just starts to break down in compost, and either you leave it in there until it's thoroughly composted, or you can take out the material after it's been 6 months, a year, depends on the size of the chamber and the number of people using it. And often what happens then is you'll continue composting it for a year or two. So you can add it to a compost pile where you've got crop wastes and food wastes and all that. You can compost it by itself. Eventually, after a year or two, I believe are the kind of standards, all of the pathogens in that waste will have died, and then you can mix it into soil for planting.
So you can use it as manure?
Yeah. In fact, it's called humanure.
Nice.
There's a great book called The Humanure Handbook. That's one of the Bibles of this question.
Excellent. This is good reading material while you're using the chamber.
Yeah. It's a very simple system, and it seems obscure because it's become very uncommon, especially in the West, and because there's a kind of a social stigma to not using a flush toilet, because there's a huge social stigma to handling human waste. With the compost toilet, if it's well designed, if it's well ventilated, if you're adding enough cellulosic material, then the waste breaks down and it doesn't smell. It doesn't even resemble human waste. It resembles compost.
I was going to ask about that because that is a very common question. What about the smell?
Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, with any toilet system, if it's not functioning right, if it's not well ventilated, if you're not adding enough material, it'll smell. But I've used a lot of compost toilets and one that works well, which is not complicated. It just needs to be well built and maintained. And this is one of the questions is regular maintenance. It'll smell kind of sweet and earthy like compost.
Nice. I've also seen diagrams of composting toilets where there is kind of a vent that goes up to the roof to vent out some of the carbon dioxide and perhaps the odors as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's an important part of it, is that allows air to flow through. And there's a design of a pit toilet that's called a ventilated improved pit toilet, which is actually designed on the model of the termites mound, where basically the hot air in the toilet chamber rises through the pipe, and that essentially draws air through it. It draws air from the toilet seat down into the chamber and up through the ventilation pipe, and it takes out any smells.
So basically what I'm hearing is that it's actually very safe to use human waste that has been treated through composting as fertilizer for human crops, and that you're protecting the groundwater by actually having a sealed chamber. It's not like just a regular hole in the ground where it's just dirt. You actually have some cement or ceramic implement that you're putting your waste into.
Or wood. And in fact, if you know where your water table is and you know where your drinking water well or pipes are, you can actually build a compost toilet that is unsealed. You don't want to do this on a large scale in a highly populated area, for example. In fact, the pathogen question is, it's not as deadly and dangerous as we may think. There are, of course, a couple of pathogens. Hepatitis A, roundworm is a very common one around the world, that can live for long periods in waste if it's not basically given enough heat, which is what compost naturally does. A good compost will heat up hot enough over enough time to kill those pathogens. So it's not to say that there's no risk, but it is to understand the relative risk. If you're using a compost toilet in, say, a family compound, if nobody there has hepatitis A or roundworm, then those are not risks. So you can put that waste right on your food and, not on your food, but on your soil and grow crops. Whereas, if you don't know who's using it and, there could be pathogens coming in, you want to be much more careful with the way you handle it.
Or let it compost for a longer period of time.
Yeah, which is essentially what I mean. Compost it in a place where it's well known and well marked, and give it a year, 2 years, and make sure that the compost heats up sufficiently so that everything in it dies.
So there's a couple practical questions about who gets to empty the chamber, because I think the attraction of the current system that we use in the Western world is that you flush it down and you don't have to think about it, and somebody else has to deal with it. And the only real quibble is who gets to clean the toilet in the bathroom, and then that's it. Like, it's a public work that we pay taxes for somebody else to do that work of managing our human waste. So, but in a composting toilet, that's an issue of who gets to empty the chamber and where does it go. And then the other part of it is also, how do you clean the upper portion of the toilet without introducing chemicals and other things that might destroy the composting process?
Right, and this is where it becomes a cultural issue and even a political issue. There's probably a good reason why the culture that favors compost toilets is the same culture that favors collective living and essentially hippie culture, because there you've got people who reject Western values of individualism and the degradation of labor. Because what has happened traditionally, before we had waterborne sewage, or what we call flush and forget systems, you had people emptying out toilets. So in India, it was the Dalit class for hundreds, thousands of years. And this is part of where the word untouchable actually comes from, is because these were people, their role in society is to handle human waste. Well, that's not, from an ethical, from a moral standpoint, certainly from my cultural perspective, we can get beyond that. We don't need to enslave people in that way. And so one of the very important pieces of a compost toilet system is the management. Governance, you could even say, is transparent agreements among the people using it to clean the toilet together, and not have it be based on some social hierarchy, whether it's gender, whether it's class, which is usually how those things fall out. And this is really where the compost toilet becomes not just ecological, but socially revolutionary. It's all about horizontal social relations. It's about people, you know, working together to clean the damn toilet, and not about abusing and exploiting water resources, and not about abusing and exploiting people. It's actually about working in harmony with nature.
Right. I mean, we all clean our own body after we eliminate our waste, but we're reluctant to then handle it once it's left our body.
The other question you asked is about cleaning the toilet in terms of chemicals. Will that harm? I mean, this is another Western industrial idea, is that we need ammonia, we need bleach, we need some chemicals that we don't even know what they are to clean. Well, it turns out you can use vinegar, you can use lemon, you can use hot water and soap.
So will the soap or the vinegar or the lemon interfere with the composting process?
If you doused your compost in vinegar, it would probably kill some of the beneficial bugs that you want in there, but no.
Great. And can you explain a little bit more how the dry toilet works?
Yes, indeed. When I started researching compost toilets, I thought I was talking about compost toilets, and I had several United Nations affiliated global sanitation experts correct me, saying, you're not talking about compost toilets, you're talking about ecological toilet. And the most commonly used one around the world is the dry toilet. There are several different kinds of models, but basically a shallow pit, say 2-3 feet deep, maybe a little deeper, not lined on the bottom. Because when it's shallow, you ideally aren't running the risk of getting in contact with the water table. With some of them, you can poo and pee in there, and you throw enough dry material in, ashes or lime, that desiccates the material. And after it's full, you cover it with soil, and you leave it for a while. And 6 months, a year later, it's dried out, if no water is getting into it.
What about the pee?
Okay, that will dry out over time if you're adding enough dry material and if you're in a dry environment. I, for example, lived in New Mexico for a couple of years, and I made one of these, and it was amazing how quickly, you know, there are a lot of places in the world where it is so dry that the dryness of the air is actually an asset to this kind of operation. But there's also, and this may sound strange, but there's a kind of a toilet seat that was designed in central Mexico that's being used throughout Latin America that is called a urine separating seat, where you basically have a division and the pee goes forward and goes into a pipe that goes into a either a closed container or directly into the soil, because pee carries very few pathogens.
In a normal healthy person, urine is sterile.
Yeah, yeah. And so then the poo goes into a different chamber. In one of the ones that I've built, I actually used the buckets that the U.S. Postal Service uses to deliver the mail. That's an aside. But you can use a plastic bin and you throw enough dry matter on top of it that when you pull it out, you have like a door in the back of the chamber and you pull that out. And I would just literally bury that about 2 feet deep under my garden soil and then put soil on top of it and grow vegetables in it.
Are there any pathogens to consider in the dry toilet?
The same ones. I mean, again, roundworm, Ascaris. Takes about a year for that to die in a completely desiccated environment, and hepatitis A, but that will die as well.
So either way, whether you're using a dry toilet or a composting toilet, you should let it sit for about a year before you put it on your agricultural land.
Yeah, and there are a lot of books on this where, you know, if you really want to do this right, you could even, you know, have a thermometer and measure your, take the temperature of your compost pile. But I think the standard is you let it sit for a year or so and make sure that that compost is heating up the way a good compost pile should.
The waste in a dry toilet will also heat up?
Right. No, it won't. What that will do will just desiccate. And in fact, it loses huge amounts of volume. You'll have a bin full, and that will reduce by about 2/3 and just turn into dry powder. I actually first learned something about this when I visited the head of water and sanitation at the United Nations Development Program in his office at the UN in New York. And on his bookshelf, he had a little jar filled with what looked like dust, and it was dried up shit from a village that he had worked in Tanzania years before.
His own?
His own may have been mixed in there. We didn't get into particulars.
I want to ask you about the practicality of using ecological toilets for high density living, particularly urban areas where we have multiple units in a building or even high-rise buildings.
Yeah, that's where you get huge challenges. It's not always appropriate. It may not be. There are multi-story buildings in Yemen, actually, which have hundreds of years old dry toilet systems. And this is a really interesting case. You'll have a toilet on the third floor of a building, and the waste goes down a pipe into a chamber that's periodically emptied out. And it's just like here. I mean, you live on the 27th floor of a building here and have a sewage system. The water is taking your sewage out. And
so what's the big difference? Not a big difference, except that you don't have the water involved.
Right. And one of the things, I mean, sewage is basically built on a number of illusions. And one of those is we believe that it's going to be treated somewhere down the line. In the U.S., for the most part, that's true. But in many places around the world, in Latin America, there are actually very few sewage treatment plants. So even if you're staying in a high-rise luxury hotel in Cancun, you use the toilet, that sewage goes out to the ocean. In a lot of places, it goes to the rivers, the bays, it goes to waste ponds.
That's why they tell you don't drink the water.
Right, and that's why there's epidemic diarrheal issues.
Cholera, typhoid, etc.
All of that. Is it going to be any worse to develop what they call on-site sanitation systems, meaning a compost or dry toilet system for, you know, a very dense populated area? Or is it better to have all of those people shitting in the water and then dumping it on people who are living downstream? And that's usually, you know, the poorest people. This is all around the world. You've got sewage running into neighborhoods that are, you know, informal settlements that are slums. That's part of why you have epidemic diarrheal diseases.
This is so interesting and really informative, and a lot of the misconceptions around ecological toilets have been clarified. Is there anything else you want to add?
One of the things that I think is important to understand when we think ecologically, whether we're talking about toilet systems, whether we're talking about farming systems, whether we're talking about building systems, is that there's no one silver bullet solution. You need a diverse array of options. So one of the reasons I think people may assume that compost toilets are just a hippie fantasy or something like this, or they're not appropriate, is because they're not always appropriate in every situation, just like sewage systems aren't always appropriate in every situation. So for me, that is the essence of ecological thinking. It's place-based, and it's built on an understanding of diverse ecosystemic needs.
Great. Thank you so much, Jeff. It's been a real pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you. This is a fabulous conversation that you're getting going.
Jeff Conant, author and international environmental justice activist in Oakland, California. If you'd like to share your thoughts about or experiences with ecological toilets, feel free to comment on our website at www.neijingnow.org or on our Facebook page for Naging Now. Our concluding poem. Is it because I live in a world of cement that my muscles behave like rocks? Is it because success involves the grind of steel gears that my will stands like an iron pillar? If I walked on the soft earth with my bare feet, would my body dance like the waves upon the rocks? If success was as delicate as a lotus on a pond, would my will have the grace and depth of the great ocean before me? Naging Now was written, edited, recorded, and produced by Dr. Jayashree Chander.
Website by Takahiro Noguchi.
Tabla and manjira played by Jayasi. Compositions from Pandit Swapan Chowdhury. Bass guitar by Pedro Ordonez. Drum set by GC Garcia.
Multi-instrumentalist Dave Rosenfeld.
Concluding poem written by Jayasi. Distributed by Gypsy Jace Productions. Found at gypsyjace.net. gypsyjace.net. You can find us on the web at naginnow.org. naijingnow.org.
Naging Now is an entirely listener-supported endeavor. Please donate generously if these shows are beneficial and enjoyable. Your support is essential to keep this program alive.